Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week on our chat with Justice Minister Andrew Little, I asked about the banking sector being accredited with the living wage standard, extradition processes now that the government has suspended its extradition treaty with Hong Kong, and his a new protections for migrant workers with Immigration Minister Chris Farfoy and Foreign Minister Winston Peters. But first, I asked Minister Little about the concerns of returning New Zealanders.
The major issue is every New Zealand citizen and resident has a right under our New Zealand Bill of Rights Act to freedom of movement, and that includes returning to the country if they're somewhere else. We have to respect that and observe that. You can limit that right if doing so is justified in a free and democratic society. So I think we got to was that people returning to the country, you know, New Zealanders returning, are already under effectively compulsion to go into managed isolation or quarantine. That's a limitation on people's rights. To then charge them, or at least part charge them, for that is a further limitation on those rights. And the question is, what would a court think was justified in the circumstances? We erred on the side of saying there is enough compulsion and therefore limit on freedom of movement by merely requiring people to be effectively detained in managed isolation or quarantine. And charging on top of that would be an unjustified limitation. That said, we thought that it was practical that for those who are in New Zealand at the moment and wanted to travel overseas with the intention of returning in reasonably short order, that you know that when you come back, you're going to have to go into managed isolation. That becomes just a part of the cost of your trip, and you should pay. Likewise, those who are crossing the border largely for economic reasons, that is to say, you know, to take up a job or being paid to by a business, then actually that's part of the cost of that trip, and you should pay that cost. So that's where we landed in the end.
I talked to some overseas New Zealanders throughout the past couple of hours, and one is particularly upset because he booked his tickets to back home for Christmas like ages ago, and now he's has to pay for isolation and he's now thinking of cancelling his trip to see his family altogether because it's becoming unaffordable. Yes, and I frankly see some other cases like these on being shared on social media as well. So I'm just wondering any thoughts on this.
Yeah, look, there will be some people who want to return on a short-term basis. I mean, obviously, we're very keen for those who've gone off on their OE and are coming back on a permanent basis, or who may have been overseas for some years but are coming back to commit to return to New Zealand and stay here and be here long-term. We want those people back. But there are some people who wanted to come back, have the benefit of a country that is COVID-19 free, and then go back to, you know, wherever they came from. And we kind of think, well, just for that short-term visit, actually, you know, you get the benefit of what everybody else has done. You're not making a long-term commitment to be here. We think in those circumstances, that is justified to pick up the part cost of that managed isolation. And we think that would be justified if somebody were to challenge it in court. So it is, look, these are all about a balancing act. But in the end, we've come down where we've come down. And I think for those coming back, there'll be people want to come back and see family for Christmas. But if it's just for the short-term basis, they get the benefit of, you know, the sacrifices that everybody else has made, and they should be held to that.
Yeah. Let's move on to a topic that is under your portfolio, the living wage being accredited to the banking sector. So, yeah, I just want to know, what is this about?
Well, the living wage movement, Aotearoa, has an accreditation process. Up to now, they've largely accredited individual employers or enterprises for committing to being a living wage employer, and that just means it's not just their direct employees, but any contractor to the business has to commit that they are paying no less than a living wage. So for banks to do that, I think, you know, most bank staff will probably be above the living wage. But they've got cleaners and security guards and others, many of whom will be contractors. And so the fact they've made the commitment that those personnel will be paid at least a living wage is a big step. And the reality, if there's one bunch of organisations who can afford it, it will be the banks. So I think it was a good thing for the whole banking industry to commit to and to do, and the living wage movement Aotearoa has, they've audited it, they've checked it, they're satisfied that the banks are serious about it and are doing it, and therefore have given that accreditation. I think that's a very positive move, and hopefully gives a signal to other industries, particularly those that are industries that generate a fair amount of revenue and profit, that they then follow suit.
But is the government going to take a more active role into promoting industries to take up giving out living wages to their workers?
I mean, the government's role really is, we haven't been involved in the accreditation process. We were invited to celebrate, and we were invited to kind of announce it, which we did. We work with the living wage movement Aotearoa when the government considers the minimum wage. They're one of the groups who we consult. We want to make sure that wages in New Zealand are at a level that means that people can, live without struggle. And we consider that when we're setting the minimum wage. The living wage is typically set at above the minimum wage. The living wage is intended to or designed to allow an adult couple with a couple of children to live with a degree of comfort, and it's an income that means that at least one of those parents gets a sufficient amount of time at home with children. So they have a different formula than when we're setting the minimum wage, which typically relates to young single people. But the government's role is to see what is happening with incomes generally. Where the government sort of takes a more active role is when we are, setting laws or regulations that relate to the setting of wages and incomes and collective bargaining rules, that sort of thing. We do want to see an upward movement of wages. We've got major issues of low-income families, child poverty, and one of the ways to address that, one of the most important ways, is to make sure that incomes are sufficient to enable people to live with a degree of dignity.
Speaking of living with dignity, moving on to another topic, it's about migrant workers. So recently, you and the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Immigration Minister have announced some measures to ensure the protection of migrant workers. So, yeah, can you give us a little bit more detail on that?
Yeah, we know that a lot of migrant workers have had a pretty rough deal. They come over here, particularly those coming over for seasonal work. They come over here to do that work. There are some employers or some labour hire agencies who specialise in employing and deploying migrant workers, who give them a pretty rough deal. And look, some cases get to court, and that's good, and justice is done. We had a case out of the Hawke's Bay recently where a group of workers were basically abused by their employer. Their ability to even get back home to the Solomon Islands was impeded quite unjustifiably and improperly. That sort of stuff goes on. So what we've said is, particularly at the time of COVID-19, when there's quite a few migrant workers who are stuck here, they can't get back home, we want to make sure that they are protected. We've put in a number of measures. One of those is to ensure that if they are dealing with a dodgy employer, because their visa is typically attached to that employer, then they can easily apply to change employers and in a very easy sort of process, so they're not stuck with a bad employer. Secondly, putting in more investigators and inspectors so that there are more people on the ground policing what's happening and making sure that the rights of migrant workers are being respected and observed. And then making it easier for migrant workers to get access to advice by setting up free phone lines and that sort of stuff. So a number of measures there. Some of that will take a little bit longer to roll out. We've got to introduce some law changes, which won't happen until after the election. But this is about making sure that when migrant workers come here, that they know that they've got adequate protection.
You had a look at some of the measures that you just talked about beforehand, and frankly, I think some of them are a little bit passive, because some of, like the phone line, they really rely on migrant workers to report any infringements by the employers, and considering sometimes the migrant workers don't have any means to contact the outside world because some of their communications devices were taken away by their employers in the first place when they arrived in New Zealand. So how are they able to report any infringements on that if they don't even have a phone?
Yeah, I mean, look, that'll be true for some migrant workers, but the reality is the cases that the government agency has been dealing with most recently, and indeed for some years, typically comes from notification by an affected worker, a migrant worker. So people are notifying of us, and then an investigator will go out, and invariably then we'll discover that there's other people affected, and some of those may be people who've had phones and passports taken off them. It is one means of notifying the authorities about something that has gone wrong. There are community organisations that are in the field as well, and part of what we do is we support those organisations. And once we get a notification that there is something wrong with this package, we will have more people at our disposal to send out and investigate what exactly is going on.
But are those inspectors and investigators going to be proactively patrolling those who are hiring migrant workers to ensure there are no rights being breached, like surprise inspections and something like that?
I'm just not quite sure whether they do surprise inspections. I know they do, particularly at the beginning of the seasons where there is seasonal work involved. There's a lot of inspection of facilities, particularly accommodation, because we know that there's been some pretty substandard accommodation offered to migrant workers. So there is that level of sort of engagement by the authorities. And there is the sort of random checking on people, particularly those who are big employers of migrant workers, and we know there are big clusters of migrant workers in particular places. The field staff, the inspectors, the investigators, they do go around and just check what's going on. But the reality is, an inspector can turn up and they won't see everything. They won't know, actually, until they're talking to the people concerned. And sometimes, depending on the nature of the workplace and what is going on, actually the inspector needs to be able to talk to them away from the presence of their employer or a manager or a supervisor, because sometimes if things are not good or things are going bad, there is an element of fear, and in order to disclose, people need the right sort of circumstances to do that in. That's why the different communication lines are being set up, so that people can do so at a time of their choosing and in a way that they feel safer to do so.
Hmm. And my final topic for today, it's a quite short one, but recently the Deputy Prime Minister has announced it will suspend its extradition treaty with Hong Kong. So I'm just quite curious on the process of extradition in New Zealand here. Hmm. So if there is no extradition treaty in place, how does the process work if one country that wants to extradite someone from New Zealand, how does the process go?
We're under our Extradition Act. A country that we don't have an extradition treaty with can still apply to have somebody extradited. There's a bit more of an involved process to go through. The critical thing is to make sure that the charge that the person is being extradited for is a charge that we recognise in our own law. So something, if it's manslaughter or murder or something like that, then yeah, we would consider that sort of application. We'd want to see the prima facie evidence, of course. If it's a charge like, sedition or undermining the government or whatever, then we're going to give it pretty short shrift. We're not going to extradite somebody for that, because that starts to sound like a political exercise. So we can extradite to countries that we don't have a treaty with, but we look much more carefully at the circumstances in which the request for extradition is being made.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.